Hello, it's Thursday, 25th of April. I'm Hannah Pearson. On today's show, Gary Bauman and I will be rounding up the top eight travel and tourism talking points from across the region during April. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So we're pretty much one third through 2024. So what were the top eight talking points in the month of April, the fourth month of 2024? Over the next 30 minutes, Hannah and I will travel around ASEAN and beyond with stopovers in Singapore, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, China, and Dubai. So, Hannah, where should we start?
Well, let's start off with holidays. It's always nice to talk about holidays. And of course, April was a huge holiday month for the region. We had Songkran, we had Pimai, Qingyang, Khmer New Year, Eid. Pretty much everybody got a holiday, I realized, except Vietnam. So sorry, Vietnamese listeners, if you're listening and you had to struggle on. But, you know, as always, once we have these holidays, there's always huge media interest in the results. And they're pretty good. So if we start with Cambodia, something like 22 million tourists traveled over Khmer New Year. Now, I was trying to scratch my head a bit because the population of Cambodia is not that big. And this also includes, it's mainly domestic tourists, very few international tourists in that number comparatively. But I guess maybe people were taking multiple day trips. Perhaps that's how they count it. I'm not entirely sure, but it was bigger than last year. So 22 million, big number for a relatively small country.
Yeah, track those GPS systems, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Like you were saying before, for Indonesia, how they do it. Garuda, in Indonesia. So it, of course, you know, such a huge population. Everybody is on the move for Lebaran. They're all going back home for Eid. So Garuda Group recorded 80,000 tourists on 14th of April alone, operating 531 flights. So it's a huge flow. Even if you're looking for Bali, they saw domestic tourist arrivals during the time reach 25,000 by air alone. And of course, people cross over in many other ways to get to Bali. But that's up from 14,000 on a normal day. So it's not too shabby. For occupancy rates for Thailand, many destinations saw over 90% for the peak. Lots of people traveling around by rail as well. In Thailand, we had about 6.6 million train passengers in and around Bangkok, as well as to and from Bangkok during that six-day Songkran period. And overall, about 15 million trips were made during the Songkran holiday, which is up about 8% year on year. And even if you're looking at Malaysia and Singapore, Trip.com released some pretty interesting stats that basically, there was a big uplift in tourists coming into Malaysia, but those flying from Singapore to Malaysia saw a 33 times year-on-year increase, which is kind of impressive. And I wonder, is either down to changing patterns and perhaps people are flying instead of taking a car because they want to avoid the jam, or the Singaporeans are coming in because they want to take advantage of the low ringgit?
Yeah, possibly that. And or transit from China?
Yeah. Could be as well. So loads of opportunities. But basically, tourism did pretty well, I think we could say, over the April period. And of course, now the question is, you know, as we go into May, is that going to be sustained? You know, we've seen inflated numbers because of all this holiday period. As we were saying on the podcast last week, you know, that the first quarter of the year is always pretty strong. How is it going to measure up in quarter two? Let's see.
Yeah. So there's a good point there that you make, Hannah, about this. Where are we? 2024, 2 years after the region has recovered, and we're starting to see those patterns of festival and cultural holidays and public holidays, you know, the big, big numbers coming back, both domestically and internationally, you know, going back to a pretty similar situation that we had in 2019. We've got coming up from the East Asia, we've got the May holiday, which is huge news in China at the moment about what the numbers are going to be for the domestic Chinese market and also for the outbound market. We'll come back to that in a moment. But it's kind of feeling, Hannah, isn't it, that we're going back to a lot of the challenges, a lot of the opportunities, a lot of the media hype that we had 5 years ago, and it's gone round in a circle. We had that big COVID period in the middle, and we've had this sort of growth and recovery phase ever since. But a lot of the phraseology and a lot of the statistics now are around about holiday travel and you know, these concentrated periods of tourism. But really, as we look across the year, and I've said this in countless interviews related to both China and Southeast Asia, is we really need that full year data, because you really want to see what's happening in between the gaps, in between those holidays. And after the May holiday, we don't really have a big holiday for quite a long period of time. So as you said, Hannah, will we start to see not just moderation, but perhaps drop off in some of this dynamic, you know, tourism flow that we've seen in the first quarter?
Yeah, all to play for. And that probably moves quite nicely on to number two for our news story, and in terms of going back round to stories we've covered before and issues from 2019 before. And this issue is over tourism and the 300 Thai baht tourism fee. So I get to talk about my favorite topic once more. And this is super interesting. I mean, we have had the government in Thailand have been ding-donging over whether they should implement this 300 Thai baht tourism fee for the longest time. And last year, about December, after the new government came in, they kind of said, look, you know, we're concerned that the impact this might have on the tourism industry, we will postpone this indefinitely. And they'd not really quite cracked how to collect it either. I mean, if you look at the Bali 150,000 tourism levy, they kind of figured it out more or less, although we also spoke about that not too long ago, about how they've only really covered it if you're coming internationally, not if you're coming domestically. But they've at least got something in place. The Thailand one, they really couldn't get their head around it. But what's interesting now is that it's actually the industry who are raising this issue and saying, hey, you know, we are on track to perhaps hit that 40 million international tourists this year. I mean, whether they are or not, let's see, which means that a lot of the destinations within Thailand, like Phuket, are on the verge, they say, are the verge of facing over tourism. And therefore, they want this 300 Thai baht fee to be implemented as a way to, kind of create a fund almost that will go into development. And they're talking about encouraging visitation to secondary cities. I mean, that chimes quite nicely with the whole air strategy that the Prime Minister is embarking on in Thailand anyway. They're talking about needing more connectivity between the airport into the city itself, and just the fact that they really need to rethink infrastructure. So it's, you know, we're back to that over-tourism question. It's something that I don't think we, you know, seems like a very, very long way away when we were in the depths of the pandemic in 2021, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's very cyclical, isn't it? And it's interesting that the same solutions are being put out, you know, to resolve over tourism. You know, dispersal into secondary and tertiary areas doesn't really resolve over tourism, because you're still most likely going to be flying into the main hubs and then taking connecting flights. Now, the industry is saying that it would like more direct flights to secondary and tertiary airports, but that won't happen. And if it does, they will probably get shut down after 4 or 5 months, because there just won't be the demand year round to sustain those flights. So this idea that really you can disperse over tourism, most countries around the world have tried that, have failed. So then it resolves back to tourism pricing and the fee and the tourism tax, which, you know, irony of ironies, the last, 6 to 8 months, the Thai government has been focusing on removing visa entry fees to allow certain markets, the high profile and the high volume markets, so it's easier for them to travel into Thailand, and of course cheaper, because you remove that visa fee. Now we're going back to the tourism fee, and it's just going around in a cycle, Hannah. I don't think, to be fair to Thailand, this is going to be an issue that they themselves are dealing with. We've seen it in Bali. We will see it in other countries as well. I'm pretty sure, I think I've said this on the podcast before, we're going to see a whole new range of tourism fees coming in. You know, this isn't just Southeast Asia's problem. You see it particularly in Europe, Barcelona, I think Amsterdam. You know, these are cities that have had some degree of tourism tax in place, are increasing it. But this is on a national level, and that's different to city level. It's a big challenge. And, the recovery of travel and tourism globally has been so fast, so strong, so sustained. And now we're seeing a lot of those issues that we started to see back in 2018, 2019, reemerging. Big challenges ahead, Hannah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not something that can be solved overnight, but it is perhaps something that could have had a lot more thoughts around it during the pandemic, in terms of shaping how tourism should be as they came out of it. And of course, during the pandemic, we saw a lot of talk, didn't we, about quality rather than quantity. And that's all gone out of the window. And now we're just back into the same kind of mess. I mean, it's, you know, you're interesting. You're talking about Amsterdam, because I think it was Amsterdam that I read, and I might be wrong, who are now going to put a ban on building new hotels. I think it was Amsterdam.
Unless
they're going to, you know, replace an old one. They're going extreme. Maybe that's what it takes. I don't know. There's no, like you say, Gary, it's not an easy solution. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. But certainly needs some real thought to go into this, because otherwise it's you know, going to severely impact the life of those daily residents as well.
Yeah, whatever happened to that great phrase, high quality tourism, Hannah? Do you remember we were talking about that during the pandemic? So let's move on. We've got two in the bag now. Number three is we've had a series of chaos elements, really, in travel and tourism, not necessarily related to Southeast Asia, although one of the three that we've chosen does. But these are actually more regional, from the Middle East region, where we've had issues that have caused knock-on effects, really, into our region. So the first one that we've picked, Hannah, in our travel chaos is Mount Ruang in Indonesia. And that's the rather spectacular volcano eruptions, which caused flight problems, in East Malaysia and in Indonesia, because of the ash clouds that were around the region. What was that last week?
Yeah, it was just last week. So something like 214 flights between West Malaysia and East Malaysia were cancelled. And of course, there's no alternative really to get between West and East Malaysia. I mean, you could get on a ferry and it will take you days. So really the only way to get between the two is to fly. And so if you suddenly can't fly, you know, it has a big knock-on effect. Yeah, look, I mean, understandably, and it's, you know, nobody wants to fly through an ash cloud, but certainly impacted the tail end of people, I would say, probably who want to go back after the long Eid holidays.
Yeah. And so then we had also the rerouting of some Middle Eastern airspace when Israeli drones attacked Iran. That's an issue that we can't really talk about in travel and tourism, because we just do not know what's going to happen with the escalation of that crisis. But I guess one of the impacts, the chaotic impacts, Hannah, that I think was felt most strongly, not just in our region, but around the world, actually, was the dramatic flooding in Dubai. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, so this was what they're saying, once in a century flooding. But, you know, the pictures were epic, weren't they? Just water everywhere in Dubai, severe flooding. But what that meant was, of course, that planes can't land, planes can't take off. And I think it really highlighted how important Dubai is as a hub for Southeast Asia. You know, I was out visiting travel agents on Monday, and two out of the three travel agents that I met had groups who were impacted. So one had a big tour group, I think 40 passengers set to go off to Europe, had to be cancelled entirely because they couldn't get to Dubai and therefore they couldn't get to Europe. And the other one was flying back from their holiday and got stuck in Dubai for 3 days. So it's a big impact, and it, you know, it's one of those things that makes, you know, particularly for outbound travel, which did take such a hit here, I think it makes travel agents very nervous to take those kind of gambles and operate these kind of group tours going out when you're so reliant on so many different factors, as we saw during the pandemic.
Yeah, that's true. It happened on April the 16th, so what, about 9 days ago? And apparently I was reading an article by a meteorologist from Oxford University. It said that it was a confluence of jet streams across the Arabian Peninsula, and it actually resulted in 18 months of rain actually hitting the Arabian Peninsula in 24 hours. And this is a great statistic. I don't know how true this is, but it was a huge storm system the size of France. Just imagine
that. Wow. I hadn't realized that. That is epic. Yeah. So it's just one of those things. Is it a climate change thing? Are these things going to happen more frequently? It's very hard to say, isn't it? But yeah, unfortunately, three big incidents in airspace. And it makes you realize just how interconnected Southeast Asia is with the rest of the world, and how, you know, these events happening in other parts can very, very easily impact that kind of fragile tourism recovery over here.
Totally agree. So let's move back within the region to Singapore, Hannah. A lot of reporting last week about the March 2024 arrivals figures, which were pretty good. Tell us a little bit more.
So Singapore March's 2024 numbers reached 1.48 million, which is about 95% of 2019 numbers. So I think this is the closest that Singapore has got to reaching pre-pandemic. Of course, we can't go a podcast episode in 2024 without mentioning Taylor Swift. And March was, of course, the month that she was visiting. Maybe they're linked. We'll see what the April numbers are. Who was topping Q1 in terms of arrivals to Singapore is China, who were actually reaching 82% of their 2019 arrivals. And I think that is actually a much higher number than, say, those who are returning to Thailand, or certainly those who are returning to the Philippines. So Singapore is doing pretty well for itself in, I'd say, that kind of sustained, it's been pacing itself. And it's handling it. You're not seeing reports of over tourism. You're not seeing stress on Changi Airport with that return. They've handled it pretty smoothly, haven't they?
Yeah. So the interesting thing, I dig a little bit deeper, because this story kind of piqued my interest a little bit, and particularly there, as you say, the Taylor Swift element, Hannah. So I looked into the quarterly figures of Singapore, and in the first quarter of the year, they received 4.35 million visitors, which was 49.6% up year on year. Now, overnight was 3.25 million. So they have 1.1 million people who don't stay overnight. That was also up almost 50%. But the interesting figure, I think, Hannah, relates to what you were saying about Taylor Swift. In the first quarter, the average length of stay of visitors to Singapore was 3.41 days, which is actually minus 14.3% year on year. So it's the only negative figure in these metrics. And I think that probably is related to Taylor Swift, that a lot of people came in for just a very, very short amount of time to see Taylor Swift's concert and then get out again. But if you look at the aggregate figure across the period, the total number of visitor days during the first quarter, it's 14.83 million. That's up 28.2%. So, you know, that flash incident of having so many people coming in for a short period of time for Taylor Swift has probably boosted spending. It may have ultimately dropped the average length of stay, but it hasn't really impacted the number of visitors or the total number of days spent. Singapore does seem to be rolling at the moment.
It is, I think, probably much to the jealousy of of other countries in the region. But let's stay with this, you know, Singapore and China coming into it. And the next pick was one of your stats, Gary, and I hadn't seen this one, but super interesting that Southeast Asia attracted 30% of Chinese outbound tourists in Q1. So tell us more.
Yeah, so this, I was on a webinar yesterday with Dragon Trail International and Forward Keys, and this is a Forward Keys statistic, looking at the outbound figures of China in the first quarter of the year. Now, 43% of outbound Chinese stayed within Northeast Asia. No real surprise there. 30% into Southeast Asia. So 73% of all outbound travelers from China in the first quarter stayed within Northeast Asia or Southeast Asia. If you add Oceania, Australia and New Zealand, that's an extra 5%. So across the first quarter, 78% or basically 8 in 10 Chinese travelers stayed within the Asia Pacific region. Now, that's not massively different to what it would have been pre-pandemic. And I think we've seen a lot of hype and hyperbole about how the Chinese market is changing. But overall, on the macro level, isn't really changing at all. If you then look at, you compare that to, you know, figures of like North America, it's still 5% of the market. And that's mostly because there aren't many flights. Europe is probably around about 12%. The Middle East probably is the one that's growing, I would say. That's 4% of the market, of the Chinese outbound market in the first quarter of 2024. But, you know, really, if you look at the volume figures, it's still within our region, Hannah. And I don't expect that to change in 2024. I don't expect that to change much in 2025. I think that's just the nature of the market. The total market is not back to where it was before. Again, as we were talking earlier, a lot of it is focused on the public holidays. We've got the May holiday coming up. Total outbound bookings from China for the May holiday at the moment are running around about 12, 13% behind the same 2019 figure. But there's still a bit of time. There's still time for late bookings. And, you know, we do know that with the Chinese market, particularly into Southeast Asian destinations where there is no visa requirement anymore, that there could be a shorter booking window. So that figure of 12% compared to 2019 will probably shorten. But once again, as we were talking about Hannah earlier, that's a public holiday figure. And we're going to see these booms and busts in travel and tourism from outbound markets like China across the year. But at the end of the year, when we actually do the big counting up, what will be the volumes of tourists during the down periods, the shoulder periods, and those big periods in between the big holidays? Because after the May holiday from China, there isn't really another big holiday until October. You will have the summer school holidays. That's an important time as well. But, you know, we're going to see a lot of patterns reemerge that we, at the moment, we're still unaware of. And the recovery of the outbound market in terms of flight capacity has slowed down a little bit. It's still around 32% below where it was this time in 2019. Doesn't look that that's going to move much over the coming months. So it's really going to be a tussle. You know, all the countries in our region and Northeast Asia are going to be competing hard to get those Chinese tourists back.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I've got anything more to add, Gary. You're the China expert. So it's interesting. It's just it's surprising, actually. I didn't realize quite how well they were recovering. I think only 12% down is pretty good, considering how late China reopened. I guess a lot of that is domestic travel, though, as well, is it?
No, that's outbound, but just for the May holiday. Oh, so that's related just to the holiday. If you actually look at quarter on quarter, it's much further down than that. It's around about 30% down. But it's related to that boom and bust. I think what you will see, Hannah, in terms of domestic over the May holiday, it will exceed 2019 by a considerable figure, probably 10% or more.
Really? Okay. Interesting. So moving away from China, over to Indonesia and to Bali. And this is one of your picks, Gary, isn't it? Around a warning for tourists.
Yeah, one of those stories that comes around really every year. But the health authority in Bali announced or issued a warning that tourists should take a vaccine against dengue fever. I didn't actually realize there was a vaccine against dengue fever. And this results that the number of cases in Bali have been rising. But, you know, that is usually related to climate. We're having the same problems in Malaysia at the moment because of the hot and dry and humid weather. But it kind of made a story. There was, I think, an Australian tourist who caught dengue fever while in Bali and publicized it on their Facebook page. It got picked up by various media around the world. And this is what happens. You know, Bali is now the dengue fever hotspot of the world. I don't think it's necessarily the case, but it's one of those stories that we know is just a natural risk, really, of traveling to this region. And it just highlights that at this particular time of year, people have to be careful.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So we were chatting about this on our internal chat, the Venture Travel Trade Association, because Latin America is also seeing a massive surge in dengue fever as well at the moment. And Argentina, apparently infection rates are up over 800% year on year. Wow. And they've actually run out of insect repellent. So it's like a whole throwback to running out of hand sanitizer and all of that. And Brazil was actually one of the first countries to roll out a public dengue vaccination program. But it only has enough vaccines to immunize 3.3 million out of its 220 million citizens. So yes, I think a vaccine exists, but I don't think it is one that is easily accessible right now for many people in the world.
Fascinating. Those are great statistics, Hannah. I didn't realize that. That's an update on the Southeast Asia travel show from Latin America. Thank you very much.
There we go.
So let's move on to Malaysia, Hannah. This is a story that we've talked about before, and this is about the budget hotel sector, which I think we've covered this before. It hasn't really recovered that well from the pandemic. It's struggled really over the past couple of years. And I think the last time we discussed this, Hannah, was in relation to Airbnb, where Penang government and the Malaysian government was thinking of banning Airbnbs and home rentals, particularly in condo developments, to try and help the budget economy, the budget hotel sector. But that hasn't worked. And now it looks like the budget hotels are going to raise their prices, and that's causing even more concern, Hannah.
Yeah, exactly. So the Malaysian Budget and Business Hotel Association have said, you know, many of their members' hotel rates set to increase up to 40% over the next 3 months. And of course, that comes up with issues. I mean, they claim that their operational costs are rising. And of course, we have had an increase in SST here in Malaysia from 6% to 8%. So on paper, a small amount. But when you think about the entire supply chain and everything being impacted, plus inflation, plus the fact that Malaysian ringgit is not doing particularly well, you know, people are having to adjust their prices. But of course, there's that whole, you know, if they are adjusting their prices, then they're competing with other levels, and you're then competing with Airbnb. And, you know, as you were saying, Gary, the Budget Hotels Association in particular in Malaysia has real beef with Airbnb. You could see pretty much very frequently, let's say, they're calling for greater regulation because they feel it's unfair, and they're having to comply with all of these regulations whilst, you know, short-term rentals don't necessarily have to. But yeah, it's just interesting. As you said, they're struggling. I think the fact is, particularly in Malaysia, that hotel rates are quite cheap. You know, if you speak to five-star hotel operators here, you know, they comment that their five-star hotels are going for rates much, 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 much cheaper than you would see in the likes of Bangkok or other countries within the region. And so there is that pressure, right? If the five-star hotels are at a lower rate, then everybody else has to be lower than that. They kind of set the scale. And so then if the bottom of the scale is also moving up, it's, I mean, everything is going to be impacted, I think, eventually. But they have to make money one way or the other. What's your take?
Yeah, well, I agree with everything you said. I've never understood the comparison of budget hotels with Airbnb. I just don't understand it. I don't see the linkage. I don't understand this idea that they have to comply, whereas, you know, some budget hotels are quite big. You know, you have health and safety requirements for quite a huge number of people that are staying there. In an Airbnb, it can be just one or two people. So I don't really understand that. I don't understand the pricing comparisons. I don't understand how raising the rates is really going to solve this problem. You're right about the costs. You know, everything has gone up in Malaysia, water rates, electricity rates, and this really impacts all operators. That's understandable. Solving a downturn in your business cycle and your business model by raising your rates just isn't going to work. I just don't see how that's going to work. And yeah, I think this one's going to roll on and on, Hannah. I think we'll be talking about this again in about 3 or 4 months' time.
We're bound to, because it rolls out in the media every 3 or 4 months. You know, it's just, I think ultimately the business models need to be looked at. And as I said, it's just about the entire ecosystem of hotels in Malaysia and their pricing. It's a bigger problem than just the budget hotels, I think.
Yep, totally agree. So that's 7 of our top 8 talking points in April completed. As you will probably have noticed, a fair dispersion here of challenges as well as opportunities. But I guess we're going to end on a relatively positive note, Hannah, and this is an opportunity. And this is about electric vehicles being incorporated into the travel ecosystem, and particularly in Ho Chi Minh City and Phuket. Tell us a bit more, Hannah.
Yeah, well, it's very striking. I mean, in the same week, you have Ho Chi Minh City, who announced that they're going to pilot a fleet of 70 vehicles, essentially for sightseeing, that are going to go around districts 1, 4, 5, and 6. They're going to operate from 6 a.m. until midnight. So it's pretty decent operating hours. They are paid for, but they say they're going to be integrated with other transport modes, bikes, and presumably the metro at some point too. So it's that idea of just providing another greener way for tourists to get around. And then, of course, Phuket announced that it was going to launch its own free air-conditioned bus in Phuket town. And this is slightly different. I mean, yes, it is aimed at tourists, but it also quite clearly says that it's aimed at the local residents as well. And, you know, it's going to operate in this circular route. Again, it's a trial period. Both of them are pilots. One of the interesting things, I think, about the Phuket one is that we're saying it's to enhance the lifestyle of local residents. It's a way to try and reduce congestion as well. So it's fantastic. You know, I think these kind of public transport systems that are greener because they're electric anyhow are good, and just having more ways for tourists to get around. It's that dispersal, just making it easier to move. So for me, positive, very positive story to end the lineup with for this month.
Yep, totally agree, Hannah. And I would say that electric vehicles, particularly from China, we are going to see a surfeit of those coming into travel and tourism in Southeast Asia over the next 6 to 8 months. Another story I think we'll be talking about over and over and over.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that, that brings the show to a close for the week. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on anything we discussed or anything we missed out. You can drop us a message on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yeah, and as always, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, the seasiatravelshow.com, and you can find us on any international podcast platform.
So that's a wrap for today, but we'll be back soon to discuss more travel and tourism in Southeast Asia. See you then.